Hello and welcome to episode 207 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And this has become normal. I am in Boulevard Park, Washington.
Home of the Pelton Cast? Is that what you normally say?
It is.
Okay. All right. And I'm in Renton, Washington, home of Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Hello. It's our first pod. I want it out of habit to call Zach to join us, his third Pelton brother.
Speaking of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks, feel free to listen back to any of our mini draft recap pods with Zach Whitman that we did over the last weekend. They were, I don't want to use the word fun, but no, it was always great to have Zach on. The draft really was something, and people seemed very excited about the Seahawks' second round pick. So that I would say would be the lasting impression from this draft a few days out.
All right, the other piece of business we have to get to here at the top of the show, the listener at Big Paper Daddy, going now by Kevin Calabro, bringing back and expanding the Pelton Cast MVP that he introduced last year, as won by the famous Cousin Katie, the inaugural Pelton Cast MVP. This year, there's an 8-seed tournament just to figure out who the fourth entrant is in that final poll alongside
so the
us.
Given entrance, are you and me and Katie?
Correct.
Oh, God.
You're just upset because you know you're going to finish last?
I suppose so. I'm just pulling for infrared.
So the first matchup that went up on Wednesday morning was number one seed, Remember Some Years, versus number eight seed, our friend DJ Infrared. And it is possible if you get up extremely early on the East Coast and listen to this, or listen to this very late on the West Coast, that you might be able to cast your vote before this ends. There are 8 hours left as we record this. And it's not looking good for Infrared. He's currently trailing 64% to 36%, despite getting votes from both of us.
I'm really just shocked that anybody enjoys Let's Remember Some Years, because I'm never really sure. We definitely talk about those years for a long time. Maybe we've just beaten people down with the sheer length of how long we're talking about years.
I mean, there really isn't any alternative right now. Unless you just want Seahawks draft talk for the next 5 months. We're gonna remember.
Oh,
I'm already giving consideration to what we do when we run out of years to remember, which is gonna happen.
Oh,
for sure.
There's always more years to remember.
I
we
know.
Can remember years with different people. It's fine.
We'll come up with some new. And we definitely were not as detailed in our remembering of early years.
I do like the idea of re-remembering some years.
Just remember
the podcast. Remember some years again.
Where we remembered some years. We were able to do some of those in person.
Remember the remembering of those years.
And those were good times. GT.
Remember when we remembered 1993?
It was great. What was the year we remembered with Chris Smith at his apartment? That was maybe the highlight of the remembering some years. Although the Mrs. Fantasy Genius making her Pelton Cast debut was also a highlight as well. So
she did have a fun run in a couple of years to remember before.
I assume she's going to show up as one of the options for Pelton Cast MVP. So,
oh wow!
Stay tuned to the account of @big_paper_daddy, Ricky Pierce's nickname, of course. To follow that, we will obviously be retweeting everything from the Pelton Cast account on Twitter as well.
All right.
Should we get to this week's beer?
Absolutely, we should.
I can't remember whether I had this previously on the pod or not, but I am still working through a six-pack of Bodhi that I got a while ago, so that's what I'm drinking tonight.
Well, I'm drinking from our good friends at Fremont Brewing Company, Head Full of Dynamite, Hazy IPA.
I don't know if they're your good friends after you declared something else the best brewery in Seattle, although we did get agreement on that from the listener, Tyler Gardner, on your
Petful of Dynamite, HFOD, is an ongoing series of hazy IPAs, each one different from the one before. Check out our website for the malt and hops used in the one in your hand, FremontBrewing.com. That's interesting, because I was wondering, because the packaging of the one that I have is totally different than the one that I've seen most often, which is like purple and black. This one has sort of like a bunch of like geometric colorful shapes, which I guess I'll post a picture of on Instagram.
Please do.
But so this is apparently a different beer. That's, I had no idea. So this is sort of like their field of ferment where they do kind of the four different hops. And you try, if you're pretentious, to compare those four different hops and see which one tastes different and not like each of them just tastes like beer.
I'm sorry, did you have to ask on the Pelton cast if you're pretentious?
You're like, the mosaic, I get a more floral scent than the Simcoe.
Real notes here.
That's what we're going to be doing when there's no sports in September. No.
Well, there might not be any beer. Did you see that?
What?
So apparently the carbon dioxide that is used to carbonate beer and pop, or soda, if you're so inclined, if you're not in the Pacific Northwest like us, it is a byproduct of, I think it's like refining oil to create gas, and because the demand for that is so far down, there's going to be a shortage.
There's a shortage of carbon dioxide?
Yes. This is a real problem that is happening.
Oh my God! I'm about to go on an Elon Musk style expletive filled rant about the quarantine. Now, I thought it was offensive when he did it before and classes at the very least, but now I might be all in.
Oh no!
Wow, this is not okay.
Yeah, the production of ethanol for gasoline. So. Yeah, that is bad news. So we got to keep drinking it while we can, I guess.
I mean, I'm doing my part.
I don't know if that's doing your part. I guess if you were driving around a lot, that is doing your part in this case, in a strange, perverse sense.
I love that the side effect of not creating, like, emissions gases or whatever is that we don't get beer anymore. Like, I don't know.
I mean, hopefully we'll figure out.
Having to rethink a lot of things here.
Anyways, as always, let's start out with a toast to essential workers out there, everyone on the front lines providing health care and working in grocery stores, restaurants to help keep us fed. Appreciate all of that.
Keep driving. Drive more.
Just drive around aimlessly is your suggestion.
A toast to those loyal commuters. Oh Lord.
Well, should we get into the number one seed?
All right.
It's time for Let's Remember Some Years, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza.
Because Pagliacci Pizza is always better than 500, much like the Mariners in 2007.
Oh man, I would have gone with one of the other ones here. I'll maybe mention that when we get to it. Anyway, we are talking about the year 2007. So let's start with the Seattle Seahawks, who for the fourth consecutive year, I think the fourth consecutive year, were champions of the NFC West. Started out just 4-4 after an overtime loss at Cleveland in Week 9, but then ripped off five consecutive wins, starting with a 24-0 victory over the San Francisco 49ers on Monday Night Football. Clinched the NFC West in Week 16. And then played reserves in the second half of a 44-41 loss at Atlanta in the regular season finale, which sounds like a fun game. I have no memory of it.
I'm like, man, did that game matter to...
To Atlanta?
I guess it... Yeah.
I don't know. I'll have to take a look at that. Like, they were definitely
played their reserves and still scored 41 points?
Yeah. I mean, some of those obviously were in the first half. But also, Seneca Wallace, low-key not that bad.
Is this, how is this year just gone from my mind?
Atlanta also was 4-12 at that point, so that may have been a factor in it. Bobby Petrino had left the team midseason after 13 games. They finished 29th of 32 in both points for and points against.
So Jim Mora was on the other side of that one.
Correct. Yes. They were preparing to hire Mike Smith. Anyways. Seahawks hosted the Washington professional football team in round one in the wild card round, got a 35-14 win. They trailed that one 14-13 with 12:38 left in the game, but took the lead for good on a touchdown by DJ Hackett, and then got pick sixes from both Marcus Trufant and Jordan Babineau to run up the score.
I really have vague memories of that game. I remember the next round a lot better, but that Washington game is gone from my mind.
I have some vague memories.
Did we watch that together?
Probably. I don't see any reason we wouldn't have. I mean, that was a team that was starting Todd Collins at quarterback.
They really have played Washington in the playoffs quite a few times and have pretty much never played a memorable game against them.
That's fair. I will buy that. They're always just like super workmanlike victories.
They really, I mean, the one that I remember the best, I think, is the Russ's first playoff game at Washington where RG3 like blew out his leg. Yes. And I really remember that best just for how terrible their field was.
Which weirdly they have like super low injury rates, and Century League Field has by far the highest injury rates in the NFL.
But wait, really?
Yeah.
By far the highest in the NFL?
I mean, I don't know if it's by far, but I think it is the highest when Football Outsiders has studied this.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. That was the final game as head coach for Hall of Famer Joe Gibbs after his comeback. So the Seahawks then traveled for the second consecutive year to the Midwest for round two, this time playing in the snow at Green Bay. Wait, that was in the snow, right? I don't
think so.
I don't know if I looked this up, but that's my
distinct memory. I'm pretty sure it was.
Memory.
I believe it was a Sunday morning. Oh, yeah. And it was just like,
That's looking pretty snowy.
So the Seahawks went out and took a lead right away. And it was definitely one of those moments where, we knew that the dynasty was kind of over for the Seahawks at that point. I don't think we had any, like, real notions that they were going to advance to the Super Bowl. But there was a moment there at the very beginning where I was like, oh, crap, we're going to do this. And then things turned very quickly one.
Yeah, it was extremely snowy. So Ryan Grant fumbles on the opening play of the game from scrimmage, and then the Seahawks take the lead shortly thereafter because they recovered I think Lofa Tutupu took the fumble down to the 1 yard line. So they take a 7-0 lead. And then Ryan Grant fumbles again, and the Seahawks cash it in for that 14-0 early lead. And then they were outscored 42-6 the rest of the way.
It's wild.
Ryan Grant ended up with 27 carries for 201 yards, while Sean Alexander, in his final game for the Seahawks, had 20 yards on 9 carries.
Wow. Oh, man. I mean, that was a beast. I remember Ryan Grant being a beast for, like, maybe 1 or 2 years there. He seemed like a Hall of Fame running back.
And then the Packers just brought in some other running back.
It really is, like, if you want to think about how running backs don't matter, you should Google Ryan Grant and wide receiver comes up first over this player who had 200 yards in a playoff game against the Seahawks. And his career was just, like, gone.
So he was a rookie at that point. He rushed for 1,200 plus yards each of the next two seasons, and then must have had an injury and was never the same. I think that was probably a factor in it. Although his yards per carry wasn't very good those seasons anyway. The Seahawks also that season said goodbye to longtime fullback Max Strong, who retired midseason due to a neck injury. So definitely you felt the end of an era was coming.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know if we knew it was coming as quickly as it proved to come in 2008, but we'll get to that next week. This was the year that the Sonics, quote, took a new direction.
That Ryan Graham's an undrafted free agent also.
Yeah. Running backs don't
matter. And as I guess he didn't play for the Giants that first year, but as rookie averaged over 5 yards of carry and almost 1,000 yards. So good thing the Packers drafted a running back in the second round over a decade later. They definitely learned.
Definitely learned their lessons. That was the take a new direction was the headline of the press release the Sonics sent out announcing that both coach Bob Hill and GM Rick Sund had been relieved of their duties after a 31-51 season.
The new direction pointed towards the southeast?
Yes, it was.
Let's say that the new direction had nothing to do with basketball.
Big bummer. We haven't talked about this guy yet on Let's Remember Some Years, but Robert Swift, we were very excited about him coming off a strong finish to 2005-06. He had started at center, had that big game against the Suns in maybe his first career start, on the day of the NFC Championship game in the Kobe 81. We're contractually obligated to mention that game every single week in Let's Remember Some Years. So he's the starting training center in training camp, but then tears his ACL in the preseason in a game at Spokane Arena, and that was basically the end of his functional NBA career, sadly. The season started inauspiciously with a 110-106 home loss to the Portland Trail Blazers, who got 20 points on 10 of 16 shooting from some rookie named Brandon Roy, who would go on to win Rookie of the Year. I just always think of, like, there was a legitimate belief among Sonic scouts before that draft, which they didn't have the chance to draft him ultimately.
Could have gotten that pick if they wanted to, but yes.
That Brandon Roy was no better than Damian Wilkins.
No better than Damian Wilkins.
sometimes it's not fun to remember years.
Maybe the most skilled basketball player that I've ever seen play. But, you know, Damian Wilkins.
That's a good moment since rookie. The Sonics started that season 10 and 11, but then lost 6 in a row, and they had dropped to 27 and 41 when Ray Allen underwent season-ending ankle surgery, basically ending the season. They lost 9 of their last 10 games to finish with their worst record since 1985-86. But this wasn't actually all bad news, because there has never been a more exciting college basketball season in my lifetime than 2006-07. I don't know if you feel the same way.
Very fun college basketball season.
And really, like, the Big 12 in particular. Kevin Durant at Texas. AC Law the fourth at Texas A&M.
AC Law IV, yep.
We're very into AC Law. Super into AC Law.
Was this the year there was, like, that 7 overtime game? Did that happen this season?
I'm pretty sure that was later. Because, like, Johnny Flynn played in that game, didn't he?
That was in the Big East Championship?
I think that was 2009. That was in the Big East Tournament. It wasn't the championship. It was, like, a Thursday night, I think. Yeah, that was 2009.
Huh. Well, that was a fun game, too.
But, like, you have Greg Oden and Mike Conley at Ohio State. You've got the Florida team that was looking to repeat with Joakim Noah, Al Horford, Corey Brewer, three guys who went in the lottery. So we were monitoring the lottery standings all year. And then comes this thrilling lottery. I will always remember being gathered in the lobby of the Sonics offices to watch this. Is Kevin Durant and Greg Oden figuring out who's going to get the top two picks in that year's draft. And the excitement of the Sonics not coming up where they were supposed to. Actually, no one realized it until a pick late, because I think Portland was, like, right behind them, and they jumped both of those teams. But no one realized that the Sonics had also been jumped until, like, whatever the next team came up where they were supposed to be. So it's Portland, Seattle, and Atlanta are the top three going to that commercial. Two Northwest teams in the mix. So I don't know if that video still exists or is playable at this point. I think it is. I think it's on YouTube. Everyone in the offices is cheering not Portland or Portland when the number three pick comes up, but instead it's Atlanta, and then everyone celebrates. We didn't even, like, stay to listen to whether we got two or one, because it didn't matter as long as you got in the top two.
Ultimately, it mattered a lot, but yes.
At the time, it didn't seem to. I mean, we were more excited about getting Kevin Durant. So getting the number two pick was probably a more exciting thing. And our director of marketing at the end of that video holds up a Durant jersey, even though there was a distinct possibility the Blazers could have taken him number one.
Wow. He just had a Durant Sonics jersey, or did he have a Texas one?
No, a Durant Sonics jersey.
Wow. Did you have one made for each of them?
I don't remember him, like, putting one down. I think it may have only been, I don't know.
Was there an Al Horford jersey too?
I'm glad.
Well, and really, an excellent 2007 draft, especially at the top, where it felt like it was just those two, but then you have a couple players who, I suppose up until this year, were pretty big-time NBA contributors at 3 and 4 as well.
Yeah, I'm not going to write off Mike Conley and Al Horford because of the fact that in year 13, they're struggling a little bit.
Well, Kevin Durant hasn't had a great year either.
Wow.
A monumental NBA draft. And I want to be cynical about it now, and I obviously am. but like in that moment, I did not even watch the draft lottery. It was like I had better things to do than you know, I was working at Rainy Dog Radio. But I wasn't paying attention to it, and then I found out and I was like, what pick did we get? And I remember talking to Katie, and when I said we, I was talking about the Blazers.
That is not true.
Like, number one pick. No, I was like, what pick did – I don't know if I meant we was the Blazers, but like I was full in on the Blazers at that point. I had a Martell Webster jersey. I had a Brandon Roy t-shirt. I remember that summer, like I puked red wine into my Brandon Roy t-shirt. It's gone forever now. I'm really sad about it. But the – like – and then I was like, what did the Sonics get? And she was like, number two. It was almost as important in that lottery. What, I'm not even rewriting history. But then the idea of Kevin Durant, I immediately went and changed my Facebook photo to a picture of Kevin Durant at Texas.
Wow.
So that's what I'm saying is like, I want to be cynical about it, but the idea of Kevin Durant coming here and the sliver of hope that the team was going to stay in Seattle and have Kevin Durant was pretty thrilling.
So new management hired shortly after the lottery. Sam Presti became the NBA's youngest GM at the time, which now he's been in the job for almost 13 years, 3 weeks before drafting Durant. Later that summer, hired PJ Carlissimo as the head coach. And then we saw the starting of the breakup. Then we saw the breakup of that former core team. The trade of Ray Allen on the night of the draft, short announced like almost immediately after the Durant pick was announced, going to Boston for the number five pick used on Jeff Green, as well as Delonte West and Wally Szczerbiak. And then Lewis goes to Orlando in a sign-and-trade deal that turned out to be one of the best in franchise history, really. They created a trade exception in that sign-and-trade. They used the trade exception to get two picks, first-round picks from Phoenix for Kurt Thomas, and then traded Kurt Thomas at the deadline to San Antonio for a third first-round pick. One of those three ended up becoming Serge Ibaka.
Great. Cool. Great news. They traded Kurt Thomas for two first-round picks. Did I hear that right?
They got two first-round picks to take back Kurt Thomas's salary because Phoenix would pay the luxury tax. Salary dump.
This was before amnesty.
I mean, amnesty was only a one-time thing with the new CBA. Two new CBAs, but it wasn't.
Can you imagine wanting to get off Kurt Thomas's salary that bad that you were willing to attach two first round picks to it?
It also like teams weren't as well managed in this regard. Steve Kerr had just taken over the Suns as GM. I don't think he would have made that trade like a year later. It was a bad one.
So that was with Steve Kerr as the GM?
I am 95% certain Steve Kerr made that trade, yes.
Wow. I mean, this was obviously – it wasn't the players that we anticipated. Jeff Green never panned out to be the star that we thought he could be. I mean, I remember watching the NCAA tournament. I remember seeing him D-up somebody way before he had ever drafted by the Sonics and being like, that dude is going to be good in the NBA. It just felt like he was going to grow into like a versatile scorer and was a great defender. Jeff Green felt like an NBA player to me, and I think – if you would have asked me in that moment who the best player was going to be from that class, I would have been just as likely to have said Jeff Green as anybody else.
As likely as Durant and Oden?
I mean, I don't know. Like, Jeff Green had proven it a little bit. Like, Oden was obviously important.
I'm sorry. Did Craig Oden not prove it? He was leading Ohio State to the championship game, beating Georgetown in the Final Four?
I'm telling you, Jeff Green looked like an NBA player in college.
Let me tell you, I thought that Jeff Green was
the fifth pick in the draft. Like, this is not.
But Craig Oden was the first pick in the draft. Kevin Durant was the second pick in the draft, and it was a bull draft with two players that were considered historically great prospects. I'm not saying Jeff Green wasn't a good prospect, but this notion that he was as good as anyone in the draft is preposterous.
This was just a thought that I had personally.
Okay,
Kevin Durant was obviously very raw.
He was the best player in the country as a freshman. He wasn't raw. He was only raw as a fucking shooting guard.
Pounds.
I mean, sure.
I'm not arguing against Kevin Durant.
You seem to be.
Photo to a picture of Kevin Durant, but I just distinctly remember watching Jeff Green in the NCAA tournament and being like, damn, that's going to be a good NBA player.
This is why scouts recommend not only watching one game in the NCAA tournament and shaping all your opinions off of it. I actually want
to tell that to people watching Jordan Brooks tape.
well, I wanted Conley. I was really hoping he would drop to five. I thought he was going to be very good. And then for like 4 years, it was like, well, I guess I was wrong about him. And then it turned out I wasn't. So
it was that long before Conley was good?
Pretty much. Yeah.
Really? Well, I'm sure that they would have traded him by that point. And also, it wouldn't have fucking mattered, so, yeah. You know. But there was a time, I mean, that draft night, we watched it at, was that the Furtado Center?
No, Furtado was just media there. The draft party was held at the EMP.
That was the EMP that we were in?
I'm almost certain it was the, oh no, it wasn't the EMP, that was the Senate draft.
It wasn't the EMP.
It was the Northwest room or whatever. At Seattle Center.
Okay. Yeah. And I immediately went and bought a Kevin Durant jersey. Just like the cheapest looking jersey. Like it was clear that they'd rush that shit together. And I went and bought a Kevin Durant jersey, which I probably still have somewhere. And it was like, this is our dude now. Kevin Durant is our guy.
I mean, the other thing about that is like the t-shirts that they had at the draft party and all the like the signs and everything said the Supes are back, which is either a cruel irony or going to be really awesome whenever that actually happens in like 2040. I look forward to remembering that year because as we were getting excited about Kevin Durant's debut, the day after the home opener against Phoenix, Clay Bennett announces that they're going to move after the season, that their intention is to move after the season, setting up a lawsuit over the Key Arena lease that would, of course, play out in 2008.
It was the entire year was that lawsuit. So, I mean, we can talk about that in 2008.
We can and will. But as Seattle was on the path to losing a franchise, is some measure of consolation. Seattle did gain a franchise in 2007 as it was announced as an MLS expansion city for 2009. That announcement coming on November 12th with Drew Carey as part of the ownership group raising the 12-man flag before the Seahawks Monday Night Football game that night, the one that we mentioned earlier, the 24-0
win
over San Francisco. I remember watching that, distinctly remember watching that at your house. This was a long time coming.
Like little did we know we would eventually join the ranks of Cincinnati and Sacramento.
I don't know if I'd put it that way. When CenturyLink Field, when that vote happened in 96, I think, part of the whole reason that they got over the top and got more than 50% of the vote is because of the fact that there was a strong push from the soccer community and this idea that this would be a home for Seattle to get an MLS franchise with MLS starting that year. And then inexplicably, MLS did not put a team here for fucking 13 years.
Both of those, I have to say, eventually worked out quite well.
I guess so. But
I mean, I'm saying the CenturyLink Field vote in general, like even if you're a person who was opposed to it at the time, right? Like, let's say that you're a Licata type who finds no cultural value from sports. Like, I'm sure that Licata sees some cultural value from soccer, of course. But
that implication about soccer fans.
I'm just the shoe fits. I don't think it does.
Soccer is a highly generational thing. Nick Licata is an old man.
All right, fine.
Unless he's a recent child of immigrants, then no.
I don't agree with you that soccer is a generational thing.
You don't agree with me that soccer is a generational thing?
I have been at those games. It's not fucking Millennial City at Sounders matches.
It's not? It's Tech Bro City. What are you talking about?
It might be Tech Bro City, but it's still an older crowd.
I do not agree with this take whatsoever. And again, I don't think it's reflective of, I don't know.
The constituency for basketball is not the type of crowd that Nick Licata cared about. And I think the soccer audience is the kind of audience that Nick Licata cared more about. That's it.
Maybe, but I don't think Nick Licata personally cares about soccer. I would be very surprised. So all this time,
I like the idea. Somehow, let's remember some years we came to debating whether Nick Licata cares about soccer. I'm not saying Nick Licata cares about soccer. I'm saying Nick Licata cares about the votes of people who care about soccer.
But those people didn't care about soccer in 2007. They didn't know they cared about soccer yet. They only learned that later. When they moved
like the
here,
rest of us.
When they moved here to work at Amazon. They didn't care about they were previously in California somewhere. They were in college. The USL Sounders were in existence in 2007. And
oh, man. Was this the year we went to a Sounders game?
There was 2 years we went to a Sounders game. They reached the semifinals of the U.S. Open Cup that year for the first time, losing 2-1 in extra time to FC Dallas at Quest Field in front of 10,000-plus, including the fabulous Pelton brothers.
That game was awesome, right? Like, I think Sabo was on the team.
Wait, who?
Sebastian Letou.
No, he was on the team the next year.
Oh, well, who cares? No, nevertheless, like, we're not going to talk about that match. We're talking about both years, as if they're one, because I remember them together.
You think there's only one of these games. There turned out to be two. We'll talk about the other one next year, I guess.
Will we?
Yeah.
It was thrilling. I mean, it was the first ever semi-professional soccer match that I went to. We had a freaking great time. I learned about time-wasting, and let me tell you, I was not happy with it.
You were aware of time-wasting. We had watched the World Cup the year before.
I was mildly aware of time-wasting. I was not aware of FC Dallas. This was the year that they had a 1-0 lead, and they just fucking wasted minutes upon minutes. And it was just like, you're playing a, like, USL team. Come on. Some pride.
It was scoreless at the start of extra time. And then Dallas scored, like, right at the beginning of extra time. And then they add another goal sometime
later.
And then
I turned to you and said, how does this work? So the game's over, right?
And then the Sounders, we were still confused about that during the CONCACAF Champions League as recently as a couple months ago, back when sports happened.
That was pretty wild. Man, remember sports?
I think that was almost precisely 2 months ago. I think that was 2 months and a day ago, and it seems like so many years. And then the Sounders scored, like, very, very late stages of that one, pulled one back, but it was too late to do anything. All right, let's talk about UW men's basketball, which missed out on the NCAA tournament after doing the math here on the fly. Four consecutive years? Not three. I guess three. I mean, it's not the math. It's trying to remember which years.
Did you use a UW statistics degree to get that?
All right. I didn't major in statistics. You know that. The Huskies, of course.
Your UW business marketing degree to count those 3 years?
Okay, I just needed to remember which year was which. So it wasn't in my notes. They lost Roy and Bobby Jones to the NBA draft, and Jamal Williams and Mike Jensen also exhausted their eligibility, but added the highest rated recruiting class in school history, led by Spencer Haas and Quincy Pondexter. That team started 10-1 in non-conference with their lone loss at Gonzaga, including a win over a number 12 LSU led by a couple of future NBA players in Big Baby Davis, who was a huge star at that point, and Garrett Temple. The Huskies then started Pac-10 play 1-6 with their lone win in that ASU game that Tristan attended opposite the Tony Romo game. Won 5 of their next 6 before a 4-game losing streak, including a midseason trip to play at number 7 Pitt, which seemed to happen a lot back then, the midseason non-conference games. Huskies finished 8-10 in conference, beat ASU in the first round of the Pac-10 tournament before losing to number 11 Wazoo for the third time that season. They were considered on the bubble with a 19-13 record, as Stanford did make the NCAA tournament at 18-13 with a virtually identical ranking in KenPom, but not only were left out of the NCAA tournament, but then shockingly did not make the NIT.
Wow.
And that will have some ramifications for the following year, which we'll get into. UW football began the Jake Locker era. And this is something I actually probably should have mentioned last week, is that, well, after Isaiah Stanback got injured, Tyrone Willingham, like, very long-term thinking, did not burn Jake Locker's red shirt. Now, it didn't work out very well, because Jake Locker was bad in 2010.
Floated him playing safety, of course, but...
No.
But, don't you remember there was talk of Jake Locker playing safety?
I mean, there was talk of it. as Carl Bunnell struggled at quarterback. So Locker's debut as starter came at Syracuse in a game the Huskies won 42-12, going 14 of 19 for 142 yards with 10 carries for 83 yards and 2 touchdowns as a runner. The Huskies then went on to beat number 22 Boise State 24-10 before getting blown out by number 10 Ohio State. Then they lost their next first five conference games. Although they were competitive, that includes a 27-24 loss to number 1 USC at a Husky Stadium. A game where the Locker TD with 34 seconds left got them back within 3. Huskies finished 2-6 in conference play, including an Apple Cup home loss on an Alex Brink touchdown with 31 seconds left. Then gave undefeated Hawaii a pretty good run in their last game at the very end of the season.
Oh, yeah. December 1st or something in the snow. Like a 10 p.m. Pacific start time.
It was snowing here. It was not snowing in Hawaii, to be fair. It was not even
in the snow in Seattle, yes.
Before losing that one 35-20. I remember, like, my distinct memory is, like,
that was
Colt
Brennan's Hawaii, yeah. Right?
June Jones, the team that then got just destroyed in the BCS in whichever game they ended up in. Yeah, I remember, like, I couldn't go over to watch that game with you because it snowed. So.
Yeah. It was, I mean, it was also a crazy late start. Yeah. I think I fell asleep. Was this, so the next year was the year that we started with Oregon in week one? Was that 2008?
Yeah, yes, it was 2008. That was a year the years in Husky football history. 2008 was one of them.
What was the year that we had that BYU game? Was that 2009 or is this 2007?
It wasn't 2007. We'll get to it.
Okay.
Do you think I was not going to mention the BYU game? You think that was not going to come up?
All right.
I told you all their non-conference games. Boise State. Like, take that, Coach Pete.
Oh, I remember that Boise State game, and Boise State laid down in that game.
That's not the one you're thinking of.
Oh, this was an earlier Boise State game.
Yeah. That was in 2011, I think. That is much later.
It's all the same. Like, how many years can we remember at once?
Really a lot of them. I feel like, was the Boise State game the one where there was, like, a Marcel Reese, like, 95-yard touchdown in one of these games?
Oh, my God. We loved Marcel Reese.
Oh, still do.
That's Pro Bowler Marcel Reese to you.
That was not that game, though. He only had a 58-yard touchdown in that game.
God, Marcel Reese was awesome.
Playing wide receiver then.
Beginning of the Locker era, though, we definitely, after, you know, it hadn't been that long, and obviously there were definitely worse years to come, but...
Worse year.
There was worse year to come. Jake Locker really had the whole fan base excited.
I mean, I have such a distinct memory of that first Syracuse game, watching it here when the famous Cousin Katie was living where I live now, and eating way too many Doritos and getting sick off
of
them.
It was Friday night before the bummer shoot that we're going to talk about in a little bit. I remember just being, like, fucking swamped with work because I was an intern, of course. And, you know, the intern workload, it gets to you. And preparing for bummer shoot and then, like, scrambling to get to Katie's to watch the end of that game. And just being like, this is awesome. Like, we're good now.
Not yet, as it turned out.
As you mentioned, Syracuse definitely had at least a good player on that team.
Did Syracuse have a good player on that team? This sounds like a Deadspin post. A classic Deadspin post, not a current Deadspin post. I'm not seeing any yet. They had a Mike Williams, but I don't think it was any of the good Mike Williamses. No, I'm not finding any good players.
A Mike Williams type.
I can't rule it out. Maybe they had some offensive lineman who was good.
Maybe there was a later victory against Syracuse where they had a good player.
They did play a Syracuse in, I want to say, 2010. It was a fair bit later that Syracuse came to Seattle to return that meeting. Yeah, it was 2010.
And they also did not have a good player, looking that up.
Ryan Nassib is, like, at least someone whose name I remember.
So he's drafted.
That gives him something over that 2007 Syracuse.
Well, the Huskies beat the crap out of a Syracuse team in the Carrier Dome who did not have a good player.
They were not good, but any win was exciting.
But the Huskies are back.
as you mentioned, the Mariners finished that season better than 500 for the first time in 3 years, I think, finishing second in the AL West at 88-74, despite Mike Hargrove stepping down mid-season as manager to be replaced by John McLaren. What I remember about this season, Felix Hernandez was 4-4 with a 4.33 ERA. When Dave Cameron at USS Mariner wrote about his need to mix pitch selection early in games, it was an open letter to Mariners pitching coach Rafael Chavez that Chavez actually showed Felix, and Felix talked about after his next start. And then he did pitch somewhat better. He went 10-3 with a 3.7 ERA the rest of the season.
The nerds must have taken a victory lap on that one. Oh, my
God. So much.
Mid-2000s baseball internet. God, I just can't even.
How dare you? We're part of that. That's SeaTac's own Dave Cameron.
Oh, well, I take it back.
Exactly.
He didn't go to Taiyo, though. We've already discussed this.
We have talked about Dave Cameron already. 40 saves that season for J.J. Putz, who is an all-star closer. And this is my opportunity to tell a story about J.J. at a Mariners game, at a Sonics game, I should say.
I was not expecting this.
This is early 2008. He was sitting courtside, and he came up to
Strike the story, sorry.
Wait, what?
It's 2008.
No, but we're remembering in 2007 because he wasn't any good in 2008.
We have rules about these things, damn it.
It was the 2000. Okay, so during halftime he stands in front of press row talking to like maybe some other Mariners player or something, and performing at halftime because like the halftime acts got increasingly more eccentric that season. An archer. A female archer who was performing, like she was like standing on her head and shooting the arrow with her feet. And there was an NBA writer sitting next to me who was like very excited to watch this performance, and his view was blocked by J.J. Putz. It was like 6'4". So he kind of like yelled at him to get out of the way, and I swear to God, I was sitting right next to him. I thought for sure that this NBA writer was going to fight J.J. Putz at courtside. Like, it was that intense. And then later...
he wanted to watch an archer shooting an arrow with her feet?
So one of my coworkers at the Sonics was the former Mariner Moose. So he knew J.J. Putz. And he came over and yelled...
Wasn't he the person who coordinated the halftime shows?
Yeah. And he came over and yelled at this NBA writer. Like, you can't be saying that to our fans... And then he got reprimanded for yelling at the NBA writer because he really shouldn't do that.
Wow, brilliant. Cycle of anger revolving around J.J. Putz.
Really, that's my defining memory of a guy who once saved 40 games in a season.
Wasn't that guy, I remember there was one time where there was like a really bad halftime show. And then there was that Bad Day song. That had a Bad Day song, and somebody in the office like played it when he came in after like a bad halftime show.
I don't specifically remember that story.
That's the story that I remember.
It's a good story. It was also the end of an era for the Seattle Storm, which saw head coach Ian Donovan resign after a 17-17 finish in first round sweep at the hands of the eventual champion, Phoenix Mercury. All the worse because Lauren Jackson was at her most dominant ever, winning MVP with the highest PER, 35.0, in WNBA history. Second was her 2006 season, but LJ was limited in her minutes that year. She was able to play her regular minutes per game in 2007. She tied the WNBA record with 47 points in an overtime loss at Washington. And now I pause to say this is another story that I think technically happened in 2008. My single favorite memory of Kevin Durant. Jada Evans, the Seattle Times. The story starts, Durant, when they first went back to D.C. for the first time after he was drafted, he was talking about his memories of, God only knows what they call that arena now, Verizon Center in D.C. And he mentioned going to a game where the Mystics had clinched their first playoff berth. And so Jada, who covered both the Sonics and the Storm for the Seattle Times, asked Durant about his like women's basketball fandom and mentioned Lauren Jackson scoring, I think she said like 43 points against the Mystics the previous season. And Kevin Durant corrects her and says, it was 47.
Wow.
Just amazing. An amazing moment. That year, Lauren won Defensive Player of the Year, and the Storm, the rest of their defense was so bad that they finished 10th out of 13 teams in defensive rating.
Man, it's like, who did we talk about? That was like the Sonics that year, right? The previous year.
Oh, when Earl Watson made all the difference?
Yeah.
I think Lauren was a bit more impactful than Earl Watson. All right. Well, that's enough on Seattle sports for 2007. Let's talk about
you always get so mad at me. Like, you're like, these take so long, right? You're like, ah, the let's remember some years. Every time you blame me, but then you're like, oh, I need to get my put story off.
It didn't take that long.
You're like, wait, look, you can't even remember 2007 without the put story that happened in 2008.
If you have a story about any Mariners players almost getting in a fight with NBA writers on Press Row, then I want to hear it.
Okay, so anyway, Graduation had just come out. Jose Lopez is pissed. '07 in music. You know, we were talking earlier, and I was like, I just don't. This year, it feels like a lot of artists don't have their like seminal records in 2007. We've talked about all these different years where it's like kind of we had the rise of indie rock through the early 2000s. We had backpack rap happen. We had me rediscovering mainstream rap music. And then I was digging a little bit deeper, and I had forgotten what to me at the time was the most important rap album that came out in 2007. Maybe, like, of the first 22 years of my life. But I'm not gonna go that far. But, like, what really stretched the boundaries of what I thought about people rapping. And this was the mixtape era. So before this one, there was the Can't Tell Me Nothing mixtape by Kanye.
Uh-huh.
There was the first track on that. On the Can't Tell Me Nothing mixtape came out May 27th, 2007. And the first song on that was called Friday Morning, May 25th. And I was like, this is my birthday. And it's the first track on a Kanye mixtape. And then he like unveiled Stronger, which just, I never heard the Daft Punk song beforehand. And it was like, when I heard that, I was like, all right, well, sign me up. Kanye is fucking back. Kanye has reinvented music. I remember listening to, there's the podcast about Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, where they were talking about Graduation, and it was like, Kanye, he did the late registration thing, it was very big, it was grandiose, and he was like, I'm going to make arena pop music now. And Stronger, to me, he took like an already recognizable sample to anybody who had any sort of knowledge of musical history, and also just made it pop. And on that, there was like, Can't Tell Me Nothing, there was Stronger. There was him remixing, like, Throw Some D's. Huge songs of 2007. Buy You a Drink by T-Pain. This was, like, I remember mowing the lawn on, like, probably May 28th, 2007, and just being like, I'm so fucking hyped for this Kanye record. Young Folks, when he had a remix, is Jay-Z and Kanye West rapping on a remix of Young Folks.
Wait, I don't remember this at all.
Well, you weren't listening to mixtapes in 2007. You can't tell me nothing. Most important record of 2007, though.
Wow.
Is not that one. Another mixtape, and it's The Drought 3 by Lil Wayne. Like, this is the reason Lil Wayne is still a famous rapper is because of this mixtape. Like, this was the peak of his entire career, excluding Nothing. And I remember by the time Carter 3 came out, I was like, oh, Wheezy kind of sucks again. Like, there are a couple moments where it's like, that are fine, you know? It's like, let the beat build. And I'm like, okay, this is pretty good. But then in a milli or whatever, but a lot of it is just kind of nonsense. On Drought 3, this is like a rapper at the absolute height of their powers. He's rapping over all of the most famous songs of like 2006, 2007, and destroying the original versions of it. And it's all freestyled. like every single second of it. He's like the way that at that time, and it feels like there was like a weird moment where it's like Weezy had done college and before like drugs had gotten him, where he had this one moment of a like massive peak, and that was Drought 3. And I don't even know, like, I don't think it's on streaming services or whatever. I had two CDs that I had burned in 2007 and played in my car nonstop. And it was like that, and then there was The Leak, which was supposed to be the Carter 3, and there's some moments on there where I'm like, this is going to be the greatest rap album of all time. And it got leaked, and he completely scrapped it. And it was like, the real Carter 3 was very successful, but it was not the same. And Drought 3 is like, this was a major, major artist at their absolute peak, putting out their best possible music.
I mean, should we talk about... the graduation, the Kanye versus 50 Cent battle on the same day their album's dropping?
September 11, 2007. It's funny because he has that line, 50 told me, go ahead, switch your style up, and if they hate, then let them hate and watch your money pile up. And there was like this competition between those two artists, and it was the moment where it was like, oh, 50 Cent is not an important musical artist anymore. I think the record was called Curtis. Yes.
I did not put any of those songs in the Let's Remember Some Years playlist.
And it was just like, it was all marketing or whatever, having the two compete with each other. But it was two artists going in two totally different directions. And it was 50 Cent, who is not like an artist in the same way that Kanye West was, especially at that time. And like, Graduation wasn't the peak of Kanye's career. Graduation was his probably initial like highest level of success and what took him to a legit arena artist. I saw him at Key Arena probably in 2008 on the Graduation tour. This was when we invented Stunna Shades. That was what we were doing in 2007, 2008. And he had a spaceship behind him. And it was like 50 Cent was not selling out Key Arena at that time. He was a singles artist who put out one pretty good record and was in the process of fading, and they had this moment, and it was like, dog, be in Vitamin Water commercials. You know, you're not on the level of Kanye West as an artist, and that's fine. Like, 50 Cent can fashion himself as a businessman, and, you know, now maybe we'll view them totally differently. But as far as, like, their heights, and the competition wasn't even close, sales-wise.
He made a lot of money on Vitamin Water.
Yeah, no, this is no shade at 50 Cent. He was more of a businessman than he was an artist, and Kanye West was more of an artist at the time.
All right, I think you were mentioning LCD Sound System.
Sound of Silver. Like, every single second. And this was one of those, like, again, another artist who has, like, not a lot of artists had their peak years in 2008. This is one who did, though. And, like...
What's it, pretty much in 2007.
Or sorry, 2007. Pretty much every single second of Sound of Silver is perfect, where it's like it builds and it grows, and so it's a record that sounds both immediate and takes its time. And I remember listening to I was right about to graduate from UW. It was that like spring period. I think this was months after it came out, and you know, UW in the spring, like, because it goes later than a lot of colleges do. Like, once you get past Memorial Day or something, like around that time period, whenever it gets sunny in Seattle, there's no better place to be on earth than the UW campus.
It's so gorgeous.
And it's perfect. You're sitting there and it's a sunny day and you can like look out over the fountain toward Bellevue, and it's like, there's no better place to be on earth right now.
That looks out at Mount Rainier. It's called Rainier Vista. That's what they call it.
You don't think it heads toward Bellevue? It doesn't face east?
No, it faces south.
We're going to need some scientists to get on that one. look, I got an English degree. But the... walking around listening to that, it was like 2 weeks before my graduation, I remember, like, I'd finished a class and I was listening to on my, like, old schools. I didn't have a fucking iPod yet. I had, like, an old school CD player. I think it was my ex-girlfriend's CD player, or maybe my girlfriend at the time, CD player. And I'd, like, had a burn CD of Sound of Silver, and just, like, starting to listen to Someone Great into All My Friends, which still, of the last two decades, are together some of the best songs that have ever been recorded in those two decades. Right?
I like, wouldn't put
those two
in.
Songs are perfect. And it sounded like the future too, because this was sort of electronic music. It was like it wasn't scary, but it was like, okay, something new is happening here a little bit. You know, like we're moving a little bit away from guitars. And I mean, like this year was probably one of the years where the idea of like indie rock moved from white dudes playing guitars to white dudes playing other instruments. But no, like between this and then Kala by MIA, it was like, okay, like what we consider indie rock is transitioning. But Sound of Silver was peak LCD sound system. I mean, they don't sell out 10 Madison Square Gardens or whatever without that album.
Uh-huh.
That's all that happened in 2007. No, I mean... Also, for me, so I started interning at the Vera Project in 2007, and this was, like, the first ever time I started writing about music in 2007. I interned at the Vera Project in 2007. I started working at Rainy Dog Radio in 2007, hip-hop music director, what up? And this was, like, I was just about to graduate from college, and I was like, I know that I want to work in music, and I've told all these people this for a long time. But now I need to actually start doing some actionable things. And I kind of just did it all at once. So, okay, here's a story. Oh, my God. So when I started as the hip-hop music director at Rainy Dog Radio, I was chosen as co-hip-hop music director with a dude named Rudy Willingham. Do you know who that is?
No.
Go look him up on Instagram right now. I feel like you'll recognize him. The like first week that we were, and like we didn't really see each other that much. We did one in session. He was in a group called Rudy and the Rhetoric, a rap group where it was him. He made the beats, and then another dude named the Rhetoric. Where we like definitely went to happy hour first. We probably went to fucking Aussies beforehand and then came back. And I think it was me and Mrs. Fantasy Genius and Chris Smith and Rudy and the Rhetoric on air live, all having clearly like been to Aussies. And we did a session with them together, where it was like I was interviewing them live on air. I think that was the only time that I was ever on air on Rainy Dog Radio. Did you look up Rudy?
This is definitely strong work. I don't know that I specifically recognize it.
You don't recognize this art? I mean, it's fucking everywhere. He did the artwork for, like, Capitol Block Party this year. Like, Rudy's now a famous person in a way. He's, like, an influencer. He's 40,000 Instagram followers.
Yeah, I get that.
And so, like, a week into my internship, or a week into my position as co-hip-hop music director at Rainy Dog, I'm like, oh, I'm going to go apply for this internship. And he's like, oh yeah, me too, which one? And I was like, yeah, the booking internship at the Vera Project. And he was like, oh yeah, cool, me too, I'm at 3. And I was interviewing like an hour after him. Like, I just met this dude and I was interviewing right after him. And I mean, I stressed and panicked about that interview. You had to like this was way more intense than any of the Vera Project booking internships I ever dealt with after. It made you like take a show and like book a bunch of local bands for it and stuff. I had to like go through and do this. There was like work to do for an internship interview. But I was lucky enough to get that interview. I went to a show that weekend when the Vera Project opened up their space at Seattle Center, which is now next to where SIF and KXP are, but was there before both of them. It was like the opening shows, and one of them, Dime Def, was performing, who again were like, they were the like local rap group du jour of 2007. I was hyped. It was Brother Ali was headlining and Dime Def were opening at the new Vera Project space. And I went there and saw the person that I interviewed with like 2 days beforehand. And she was like, hey, so excited to see you here. And then I ended up getting that internship. And really, like, that decision of interviewing for that and going to that show or whatever are why I still work in music 36 years later now.
Well, hard to believe it's been 36 years.
That was my first opportunity to work in music. I was hired to start actually working at Vera's staff in 2008, on January 1st, 2008. But it was like that moment. I remember being so intimidated. We have no children who listen to this podcast, of course. But if there were young people listening to it, and if they were looking for advice, I'd be like, don't be intimidated. Just go and be present and do the thing, and you'll be fine. And like Rudy was fine, too. He didn't get that internship at the Vera Project, but he's doing great now, right? So
what if he's like still curses you for getting that internship instead of him?
Oh, I mean, I have some rivals from 2007 also.
I bet like so many people at UW afterwards were like, oh, you got that Sonics internship? I applied for that.
Really?
Yeah.
There we go. Pelton Brothers getting internships at UW. So that was my real recommendation, or my real recollection of 2007 is that was when I started working in music. A couple of other things though. It was the first time that I ever learned of like DIY music. Previously, never heard of it. And in like the mid 2000s, this is news to you, of course. There was a real scene, like the house show scene that was happening at that time was brand new, and not brand new. It had been going on for decades. It was brand new to me and very exciting. And there were artists who were like becoming pretty popular from it. Like I think No Age had their first compilation record. Again, I'll tell you about them later. There was Dan Deacon had his album Spider-Man of the Rings, which got Best New Music on Pitchfork. And like they wanted to do a show at the Vera Project while I was the intern, and then ended up not being able to. So they did a house show instead in the North End. And it was like, that was the coolest thing that I'd ever heard of. Or it's like they decided to do a house show on like 75th in the U District. And I was like, whoa, what's going on? It like opened up a brand new world to me being there. And there were all these artists who ended up, a lot of them being very, very successful artists, but who were part of this like house show scene in the mid 2000s that was huge at the time. And the DIY punk scene, it's like it opened up this window of something that I never heard of before. The other thing that happened in 2007 was I got my first taste of VIP access.
Oh, there you go.
Capital Block Party. So my good friend Reese, who's been on the podcast, third Pelton brother, Reese Lazarus, who congrats on finishing your first year of law school at UCLA. He, as most punks do, he was working the Capitol Block Party stage at the Vera Project Capitol Block Party stage that summer in 2007. And I was the booking intern, and I kind of just followed him around. I remember Reese didn't have a phone, so he had to borrow our boss's phone for the weekend. And I was just like following him around being like, what can I help with? Well, you know, like, what are we doing? Just the excitement of being, you know, I'd been at the shows at Vera, but like being at a festival for the first time ever. And then that was the weekend. I talked about this last week, the Girl Talk show at Capitol Block Party. So it was Friday, Saturday at the time. There wasn't a Sunday back then. So Friday was the only day I could go because our cousin's wedding, Chris, was on the Saturday. And the Girl Talk show on that Friday night was like Numo's was probably double capacity for that Girl Talk show. It was fucking insane. Like, people were nuts, and hundreds of people were on the stage for the show. I'm pretty sure Reese snuck in, too, who was far from 21.
I feel like you guys were. I feel like you guys were not socially distanced at that point.
No, there was no social distance. And Chris Smith was there. It was the tradition of Chris coming to Block Party. I think this last year was the first year that Chris didn't make it to Block Party, but it was, like, him who really discovered the VIP area. And I think he might have even gone back the next day when I was at the wedding. And he was like, there's food here, and there's free beer. And I was like, dog, what? I was like, somebody is giving you food and free alcohol? Tell me more. So that was my first ever. I'd been to Block Party beforehand, but that was my first ever time working at Block Party and I guess if you could call what I did for the next like 6 years working, if it wasn't sometimes drinking an entire fifth of alcohol before the festival even opened because you were so hyped on the Hold Steady. That was 2007 was a very important moment for that.
Should we talk about Bumper Shoot?
Oh, God. Absolutely, we should.
So you were working at Bumper Shoot that year, too.
I was working for Seattle Times. I guess I was working at Bumper Shoot. So they Seattle Times approached the Vera Project sometime in the summer of 2007 and was like, hey, is anybody interested in writing about Bumper Shoot? Obviously, as you've heard from previous Remember Some Years, I'd been to Bumper Shoot for quite a few years before then. My goal in 2007 was to be a music journalist. I thought that's what I was going to do in 2007 before I understood the industry. And I was like, all right, well, I guess I'll just give booking a shot because that seems like the most important thing that you can do. So Seattle Times hits up the Vera Project and they're like, can you get a group of people together to write about Bumper Shoot for us and do like a blog, these newfangled things that are happening? In the world of print journalism, an online blog was fucking revolutionary.
Well, fortunately, we have a record of their opinion, their like thoughts about blogs in 2007. Because, well, the blog does not seem to exist with your actual reviews and descriptions of Bumper Shoot.
I'm like 40% stoked and 60% disappointed that that's the case.
This does exist. Their discussion of it in the editorial. Bumper Shoot was the Times' first experiment with allowing outsiders to blog on our site with little professional intervention. Corey Hake, SeattleTimes.com senior editor, called the approach trusted bloggers, people on the scene with a level of authority that was different from a reporter or music critic.
Doug
Kim, senior producer, came up with the idea of approaching the Vera Project. He asked them to assemble a group of knowledgeable music lovers who could report on Bumper Shoot from a fan's perspective. And that team ended up including three people who were involved with this fabulous podcast.
Can you read the names too?
Named Tristan Pelton.
Tristan Pelton.
Someone named Kate Coracino. Well, I just wanted to keep this separate from her professional work at that point. And then Mrs. Fantasy Genius was also part of that group.
Kayleen McDaniels is what it says?
Yes, it is.
Well, all of our names were different at the time.
That's true.
I mean, Katie's name wasn't different, but she just went by Kate because that was like, I don't even know if she could keep some distance. Katie fucking blogging for Seattle Times.
Hold on, we've got more quotes here.
Hake
oversaw their Bumper blog, but with a soft hand. I barely touched their postings, maybe 10 words. I kept their voice and didn't take out anything. She felt the bloggers' postings were, quote, a very beautiful compliment to the work of the professional journalists on our site. Hake felt that involving young people from the Vera Project, quote, was a perfect marriage, the perfect model of citizen, journalist, and blogger. They are considered experts by their peers. They have credibility, but at a different level than a professional journalist.
Wow. Oh my God. at the time, in 2007, if Infrared is listening, he'll remember this. The 206 proof was huge in 2007 around this time. And I remember going to 206 proof. This was local rap, like message board, right? Where people could talk their shit. And I was never like involved with it or whatever. I was a lurker at most, you know, eventually I got to know a lot of the people who were involved. But they seemed like celebrities to me in 2007, you know, and it's like the people who they were like all professional rap people in my opinion. Infrared was like a huge name on that. And I remember going on to 206 proof and being like, because Appalachian State had just beaten Michigan in one of the greatest comebacks of all time. And I was like, the Bumper blog, I was like, we're Appalachian State. The like print coverage is Michigan. And Andrew Madsen, who was writing for Seattle Times on the print coverage, was like, you all on the blogs get to be snark sharks. I remember that as a quote. And him being like pissed that we had this freedom to just do whatever. And he was like also a UW grad who was probably around the exact same age. And like, we did never in our entire lives basically met each other. But it was like, this was my number one competitor as a 21-year-old or a 22-year-old. And he's like, y'all on the blogs get to be snark sharks, and like, we have to be basically subject to journalistic like review or whatever. They had actual editors, and for us, they were only editing 10 words maybe. So that was pretty wild. After that, they called me in on like the Tuesday after, maybe the Wednesday after Bummer Shoot. We'd done this blog. It was pretty – I think that we far exceeded their expectations. You know, I think they were expecting like a couple of posts, and we fucking did it. Right? Because I was reading blogs. We were everywhere. We had a team of like 5 or 6 people who were there writing about a lot of artists throughout Bummer Shoot.
You knew a very successful blogger?
You weren't there. It's kind of funny, actually. We literally had, because we wanted video footage, and this was obviously pre-iPhone and video cameras and shit like that. Katie had this giant video camera that we brought into Wu-Tang Clan and recorded on this giant video camera and somehow sent it to Seattle Times. I mean, it's something that would be considered like, I mean, I guess 2-decade-old technology, 13-year-old technology, but it didn't even seem like progressive in 2007, what we were doing. We also having a press pass, like I remember going into the bathrooms for Wu-Tang and like sneaking in alcohol and stuff. And it was like, great, we have a great opportunity to sneak alcohol into Bummer Shoot. Which I had a press pass for the year before also. but yeah, we went in the bathroom and had like a code for like sending alcohol back and forth under stalls and stuff. And we're doing this blog for Seattle Times. So they called me in, were like, pitch us on a blog. And then I sent them something, and they were like, yeah, we already have somebody who can do that in-house, Andrew Mattson. And I was like, you fuckers. I was like, my number one rival of 2007. They were like, he could do it. And I mean, he did a blog sort of similar to that for music. I was called up, though, if you'll look at the Seattle Times archives, for a person once named Tristan Pelton. they called me up a few times to do freelance work, which I was literally never paid by Seattle Times because I didn't know how to make an invoice in 2007. The idea of, I mean, Seattle Times, I don't know how long the statute of limitation goes for freelancers. They owe me like $450, though, because sometimes the numbers that they would quote for freelancing these things, they'd be like, yeah, we can pay you maybe $250. And I was like, what? Like, that was more money than I made in a month at the Vera Project as an intern. So I wrote about a show at UW, which was Arcade Fire, LCD Sound System, and The Gossip.
That
pretty incredible show.
Hell of a show, man.
I mean, they did not, like, I don't remember almost any other time. This was not in the hub. This was at the arena. This was at BOA or whatever it was called, in the basketball arena. I don't remember almost any other time there being a show in the basketball arena.
Apparently, it was very expensive. Sophomore Kyle Hargis said he had one or two friends attending.
Kyle Hargis, who I end up becoming sort of friends with because he was in the group Universal Studios Florida.
Nice. But then at $39.50, the price was high for college students.
That's fucking steep, right?
That is steep for then.
2007 for college students?
You're probably getting like, I don't know about that at that point, but like when I was there, you were getting season tickets for basketball for $39.50.
Wow, I didn't even realize that was Kyle that I talked to. I became eventually co-workers with his bandmate and got to know. It's crazy. I went and talked to him in the rafters or whatever. I was always weirdly negative, which might have been why I was never asked. I think that was too expensive, even though I never actually sent them an invoice. But I went to the Tacoma Dome. This was day of that they called me. I think these were both like day of, maybe the day before. And they called me the day of to go to the Tacoma Dome to review Kiss 106's Jingle Bell Bash, which Timbaland headlined. Blake Lewis, who is on American Idol and was from the Seattle area, played. And the Jonas Brothers. Early Jonas Brothers. They played at like, so it was like Jonas Brothers were early, then I think Blake Lewis at some point. Timbaland was like 11:30 and nobody cared. One time he called up Justin Timberlake on the phone.
According to this, it was took the stage at 10:45 p.m. So, which is it?
Well, sorry for not pretty close for. And it's then I came home. I drank a bunch of Red Bull because, again, I had like a press access to this. I drank tons of Red Bull at the show in the fucking press room at the Tacoma Dome. And I stayed up until like 4 a.m. writing this like weirdly negative review of this show, the Jingle Bell Bash, and then filed that to Seattle Times. But yeah, the headlines, quote, Arcade, I love the quoting, Arcade Fire fires up UW crowd. That was September 25th. And then there's a print version. I don't remember which was the print and which was the web version. It was students. And then in brackets, and non, get some hot indie rock. And then the Blake Lewis, Jonas Brothers, stay up late in Tacoma.
I mean, Timbaland was a pretty big deal at this point. This was like, he had put out his own album, and The Way I Are was a huge song in 2007.
Oh, I mean, he was a big artist, but like, he wasn't, Jonas Brothers were the star of that show. He was a big artist because we talked about last week, like, he was along for the ride as Sexy Back, you know?
Along for the ride?
Well, I'm saying, like, Justin Timberlake was the star, and Timbaland was the dude who produced it. Like, Timbaland should not be headlining the Jingle Bell Bash or whatever.
Probably not.
That ended my journalistic career, actually, in 2007. Are
we not counting this?
You're calling this journalism?
In a manner of speaking, we sometimes do interviews and shit.
You never call me when you do those?
You got to do the Super interview. We haven't actually talked about who was playing Bumbershoot that year.
I said the Wu-Tang Clan.
I mean, they weren't the only ones. You mentioned, okay, so we've got the Shins were there that year.
No recollection. I think as a byproduct of running around for the blog, I missed a lot of stuff.
This was St. Vincent's debut album, was that year?
Yes.
And she was at Bumbershoot. That's what I was saying.
No recollection.
No recollection. Okay. Let's see here. Fergie. Oh, Fergie.
I do remember Fergie and Sean Paul, which I'm pretty sure Katie wrote about. God, I wish that blog was still up.
John Legend, Lupe Fiasco.
And I think they might have led into Wu-Tang.
This was also a big Lupe year. He had Superstar, which was probably his biggest song, right? I have a distinct memory of Superstar and being associated with the 2008 NBA All-Star game that I attended. But I guess I'm not allowed to talk about that because that happened in 2008.
Well, also, I remember being at that Bumbershoot. God, I wish this was up because I remember going to go see a young local rap artist called Macklemore. And playing in the Sky Church, and he had a shirt which had the skyline and like cursive across it said "My city's filthy," and I was like, I always wanted one of those shirts, and for whatever reason, never got one. And I was like, fuck, I want those shirts, and then they were gone or whatever by the time I wanted them. But I remembered like being really hyped to go see Macklemore at Bumbershoot 2008.
Still 2007. Still 2007.
Why do I keep saying 2008? Bumbershoot 2007, going to see Macklemore.
I've been told too many 2008 stories. Another song that I feel like we should talk about because of the fact that it becomes important in your life, International Players Anthem.
Oh, my God. Driving around UW as hip-hop music director, there was the station, oh, God, I want to say it was 104.9, became a rap station for a while, after post Funky Monkey, of course. I'm pretty sure it became a rap station, and they were playing. I was like driving on Chris Carcino's old street. I was like driving down it, and I heard that. So I typed a text, and I was like, "What is this?" I was like, "I am so instantly in. This is like the best Outkast song." And then there's like rapping in it, and that whole record, all of Underground Kings by UGK, the two songs we've talked about that I walked down and back on the aisle to. But that became one of them, and that whole album, the Underground Kings album, was huge.
And then we should also talk about, believe it or not, the best song of the year to reference a Sonics player in the title was not off the Blue Scholars album that year. It was instead Della Shrimp by Band of Horses.
Seattle Expats.
Yeah.
missing Seattle. there was that. Also worth mentioning, The Boxer, the seminal national album, which I'm sure it means something to you.
It does. I like dad rock.
Hissing Fun, Are You the Destroyer? Like that, the of Montreal, that like it was the peak, really a moment where Montreal felt like they were going to be a massive, massive group. And
see, I thought it was when they had the Outback song.
You know, they wouldn't have done that without Hissing Fauna.
Okay. You booked Of Montreal, right, at the Vera Project?
I did, yeah. Let's go Outback tonight.
they didn't play that one.
And then also, so Jay-Z had returned previously. He actually, you're not going to believe this, came out of retirement previously. Wow. But the real return, both spans film and music. And that was from a film that we thought would probably be very important and ultimately ends up not being very important. But
we definitely went to go watch this on the very first night it was in the theater.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like American Gangster is going to be huge. This was Russell Crowe and Denzel. And like, you know, the rewatchables that The Ringer does, like I would have assumed that it would have been first rewatchables. And I feel like American Gangster has been kind of lost in time.
Oh,
except 100%. For the fact that it was Jay-Z saw that movie and purportedly immediately went and started recording this album. He was like inspired for the first time since he'd retired to do this. And it was it was a massive comeback for Jay-Z. Whereas like, I mean, I remember there being a moment where I was like, oh, Jay-Z sucks now. He's bad at rapping. But he was definitely inspired by American Gangster and had a pretty huge comeback.
But yet the best Jay-Z song involved with it, like that the song that I associate with American Gangster is Heart of the City.
Is that in the movie?
It was in the trailer, apparently, now that I'm looking at Wikipedia.
Ain't No Love.
But it's not actually on the soundtrack. It was a much older Jay-Z
It was great. American Gangster was great. It was like back to Jay-Z being dense. He had stopped recording pop music for American Gangster. It also, honestly, similarly to the film, felt like it was going to be a big deal. And now I saw somebody tweeting at Big Waz the other day, and they were ranking Hove albums, and American Gangster ain't on the list. You know, it was definitely like, okay. It was like Time Out of Mind by Bob Dylan. You're like, yeah, okay, this artist is still good, or 444. You're like, but I still want to listen to the Black Album and to the Blueprint, and Reasonable Doubt. Like, it's not going to be the same, but it's nice to be reminded every once in a while that your heroes are still good at what they do.
Anything more on music?
I think that's it.
Let's transition then to movies. It's like the heart of the Apatow era in 2007. So we have both Knocked Up and Superbad, which is like the start of the second generation of Apatow stars, I guess.
And I feel like you and I were like not as in on that. And I guess you can speak for yourself, but I saw neither Knocked Up nor Superbad in the theaters. And like,
yeah,
I've seen Superbad one time ever.
The other movie I remember seeing in the theaters that year specifically is Walk Hard: The Dewey Cox Story.
Yeah. We were high on the Johnny Cash moment, you know?
It was a great moment. I rewatched that not that long ago. It mostly holds up.
Really? Did you watch the Johnny Cash movie? Or just Walk Hard: The Dewey Cox?
Yeah, I have not rewatched Walk the Line since I watched that with John Noach before a UW football spring game in probably 2004.
Yeah,
I think
you should have watched that before it. It would have been maybe too redemptive to watch before a 2008 Husky game. But
yeah, I guess so.
You would have enjoyed the bleak parts though.
Fortunately, we're still in 2007, believe it or not. Still in 2007. On the TV side, we have the debut of a couple of shows that I think we've referenced previously on Let's Remember Some Years, Human Giant and Flight of the Conchords.
We really exhausted Human Giant last week, but an important moment for the Ansari-Hubel-Shear combo of creators who've all gone on to pretty solid careers. And Flight of the Conchords was one where it's like another one of those sort of like basement shows, like Entourage, where you're like, what is this? I snippets of stand up, but I'm like, it's these weird New Zealand guys. And then you watch the show and you're like, oh yes. That first season of Chords that came out on Sub Pop was like, this is kind of all I want.
Did we previously talk about Clull Tickle?
Yeah, we talked about Clull Tickle.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then but we did not previously talk about the most beautiful girl in the room.
In the whole wide room.
The other thing about the Flight of the Conchords, there were more seasons of Flight of the Conchords, right? It's just the first season.
I believe there was a second season, yes.
The first season was definitely like cultural phenomenon. And the cool thing about it was the references to music that we hadn't necessarily heard before. You know, and like it was songs that were parodying. God, what is the artist? The Inner City Pressure, who they're parodying. It's like an 80s British artist.
Yeah, I know who it is, exactly who it is.
Well, you don't, because you're not saying their names, but...
I listened to them not that long ago, because they've been the soundtrack for the book that became a movie that became a Hulu show.
Yeah.
High Fidelity.
Yeah. The book that became a movie that became a TV show. That's the vertical.
Look, we've been doing this. We've been potting for a long time now, okay?
Hornby predicted it. anyway, that show, like when they go into some of the musical numbers, right?
The Pet Shop Boys. It's West End
Girls. Oh, yes. Yeah, I never heard West End Girls by the Pet Shop Boys, but I know that Inner City Pressure rules. And when they went into that, it was just like, I remember being like glued to the screen.
Yeah, it just came out so strong. Like that was like years of material that they had been working on in their concerts compressed into one season of a TV show. So it was obviously harder for them to follow up, but what a great season. Mm-hmm. Something we should talk about, though, with Human Giant. Old-fashioned fun.
Oh, we're going to have some old-fashioned fun.
I don't know whether that was 2007 or 2008, but the old-fashioned fun playlist that came out of that old-fashioned fun sketch.
Old school jams. The songs are even older school now, but they're still old school.
They're very old now. The other TV show I thought we needed to mention in 2007, very quickly, The Pickup Artist.
Oh, man.
It just has not aged well, but boy, were we into that one season of that show.
It is fun, those moments when you can watch, like, clearly, evidently bad TV. You know, I don't think any of us thought that it was good at the time. But what was the dude's name? Not Chris Angel, but...
Mystery?
God. Oh, yeah, Mystery. Cool dude.
yeah. It's really great ideas.
If we watched it now, it'd be obviously like so cringeworthy. Like it would never get to TV. But
it was cringeworthy in 2007. But yes, exponentially more cringeworthy. It's like The Office, what Michael Scott is doing. Like it was cringeworthy in 2007, but now 13 years
later,
Office
still holds up. So,
but Michael Scott in particular, Diversity Day.
But there are just some moments where you're like, you just watch bad TV and it's fun for a while, right? It's like sometimes you just need to get in the Laguna Beach for a little bit.
Wow. By the way, so sad news about Jay and Kristen. Can true love exist?
Yeah. I saw that. Yeah. They're still trapped in the Bahamas and separated.
That may have started in 2007. Probably a little after that though.
The Hills. You think The Hills started?
No. Their relationship. Oh. Their relationship. Anything else from 2007?
The Hills started in 2006. For six seasons. And Free Audrina.
I have no idea what that means, but cool.
you never watched any of this?
No, I did not.
You know, the most important thing that we never really talked about in the early 2000s was MTV's Next.
That came up recently for some reason, I feel like.
Oh, I've on a had conversation a discussion about things that are great.
Yes.
Or were you talking about Room Raiders? Did you ever watch these shows?
Next? Did I ever watch Next? Yeah, oh, Room Raiders.
Okay, great. Huge.
But there was the other one before Next.
Singled out?
Well, yes. I mean, that's been in the... I've been thinking about that lately because Carmen Electra has been in the news.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah, Singled Out was... Watch that. We watched that a lot.
Oh, my God. It was a great Hardwick moment.
It was how we learned to come up with lines about yourself that rhymed with your name.
Uh-huh. The people who are affiliated with... It's funny how sometimes those shows can happen where you're like, wow, these people really like... I'm not going to say that Jenny McCarthy and Carmen Electra are important long-term, but like...
I mean, Jenny McCarthy is important, just not for good reasons.
They still seem like famous people now. And there are a lot of people who are on shows in the 90s that do not. But like Chris Hardwick is still like he's like a current celebrity. And then Jenny McCarthy and Carmen Electra, it's like... Look at Singled Out. Not bad.
I'm trying to determine whether I'm thinking of Dismissed. Could be Tail Daters, but I don't think so.
Tail Daters?
It definitely was not Date My Mom. Or Parental Control.
Are you thinking of Room Raiders?
No.
There were two shows. There was MTV's Next, where they got onto a bus. Right. And
yes.
Then when you were like done with a person, then you'd be like next. And then there was MTV's Room Raiders, which were similar shows. And one person would go through three different people's rooms and then decide who they wanted to date based upon their rooms.
I definitely don't think I watched that one.
You didn't? Wow. Room Raiders was classic television.
All right. Well, let's return quickly to 2020.
If we have to.
If we must.
Most of us are stuck in 2008/2007.
An update from the Seattle Times on construction at the new arena at Seattle Center, which is continuing.
I wrote this as a freelancer.
You didn't get paid for it, though. Extra precautions to reduce, though not eliminate, interactions within 6 feet. Construction of walls soon to begin as part of the transition to building back up after the process of tearing down is complete. Still on track for summer 2021 completion, although no hard and fast date for that as yet. We will see if there are any sports to be played when they complete the arena in summer 2021.
Summer 2021. I think there might be.
It's possible. UW men's basketball update. Earlier this week was the deadline for early entry to the NBA draft. That passed with Naz Carter not entering his name, so he is presumably headed back to UW for another season with the Huskies, just losing freshman Jaden McDaniels and Isaiah Stewart, as expected. The other bit of UW news, Paulo Banchero, the extremely talented local product, who has narrowed his college choice to 6 finalists, including UW, as well as Arizona, Duke, Gonzaga, Kentucky, and Tennessee.
Well, UW sure is in line with all of those.
not all of those schools are going to have 2 players go in the first round this year. No,
that's
UW might
point.
Not either.
So I had seen a story recently about one of the best young guards in the nation who was committed to UCLA, who ended up recently, I think this was yesterday, decommitting from UCLA and going to a Southern California G League team.
Correct. That's Daisha Nix. And we haven't talked about this, which is, so the G League a couple weeks ago announced that they were going to, you know, previously they had a program where players could skip college and play in the G League, but they were basically making G League salaries, more or less, maybe a little bit more. Now they have done it so that suddenly these players are going to be making a substantial amount of money, and that they're legitimately
What's the difference?
Now,
what changed?
The NBA decided that it wanted players not going to college. I guess.
I mean, this has happened within the last couple of weeks, you're saying?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's
this
very
is a war
recent
on
change.
College basketball, right? Like, this is shots fired at college basketball.
I don't want to say it's a war on college basketball because college basketball doesn't need these players to exist. The high school era happened. Like, all those guys, the guys who will be doing this, there was a period of time already where they didn't go to college basketball, and it was fine.
Well, I
it was actually great
for
you,
however, because now you're putting in two different options. You're saying you can go straight to the NBA, or if you're not good enough to be drafted straight to the NBA, you could go to the G League right away.
No, I mean, the high school, the age limit is still in place. Maybe at some point it won't be. But then probably they will not be doing this the same.
You don't think that will happen too?
This is like, they're targeting now the best of the best prospects. And the other thing that changed is, so previously, you would just be randomly assigned to some G League team. And that G League team would have no real incentive to play or develop you. Like, they would have nothing invested in your development, and you mm-hmm. could be in Grand Rapids, Michigan, not to pick on Grand Rapids.
Is it Grand now, Rapids in Michigan? I guess, yeah. Grand Rapids is, yeah. Yep.
So now they're putting this team in Southern California. I believe the report was that they may play at the Kobe Bryant Academy in the L.A. area. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to be in a big city. You're going to be based there. You're not going to play a full G League schedule. You're going to play some number of games against G League teams. So it's a much more favorable situation on top of, again, the financial aspect.
Who else do you play if you're not playing a full G League schedule?
I think a lot of practice, you know, practicing, and those practices would be open to NBA scouts, that sort of thing. And they talked about maybe playing some of the other academies that the NBA has abroad. Would be a possibility. So Jalen Green, who's the number one prospect in 2020, was the first player to be signed to this group. And he's making, you know, the reports are $500,000 to go play in G League for a year. So that's
so who's paying that money?
The NBA.
And the NBA is negotiating these salaries?
Yes, individually with the players. And so that... Also, Isaiah Todd, who had been committed to Michigan, has committed to playing for the G League. And then what made Daisha Nix interesting is, like, Todd probably wasn't going to play college. He was looking at other options to play overseas, potentially, before deciding to play for the G League. For Nix, it was somebody who was all set to go to UCLA and then all of a sudden decided to go play for the G League. So that's an interesting milestone here.
Is college basketball finished the way that it's structured?
It'll be different. Like I said, it'll be more like the era where high school players entered the NBA, where, like, sometimes you're going to sign kids and they're just not going to come to your school because they're going to go play professionally instead. But you don't have the guys that are only on campus for 6 months and the experiences that have gone very poorly for UW in particular.
I mean, there's still going to be one and done players. Even if
there still will be, but not to the same degree. Like, the guys who have no interest in going to college, but are just going to college because they feel like they have to, those are the players who aren't going to do it now.
What do the colleges do to incentivize players to go there, though?
Well, I mean, this is not the impetus for this, but we had some updates just today on what they envision for, you know, the name, image, and likeness compensation that is coming because of California's vote. So a working group recommended, you know, you're going to be allowed to sign endorsement deals with third-party companies, including shoe companies, which is part of this. Like, Jalen Green already signed, I think, his shoe deal.
Damn.
Hypothetically, this could allow for the return of video games, although that's tricky because of the fact that, you know, you'd have to deal with every player individually at this point. And this the plan is for it to go into effect in the 2021-22 academic year.
still, getting sponsorship money as a college student is pretty huge.
Yeah, it's definitely a positive step.
There's no limit on that, right?
In terms of, like, the most you can make?
Yeah.
Not that I've seen at this point.
Interesting.
All right. Let's wrap up with the Seahawks, who continue to await a decision from Jadeveon Clowney. ESPN Seattle's John Clayton reported on Monday that Clowney might wait months to sign. The thinking here being that, you know, other teams are perhaps reluctant to make big offers to him because they don't know his medical situation as well as the Seahawks do, and that will be difficult to determine while we're quarantined, and that he may wait until, you know, there's the ability to go travel to visit these teams and meet with them in person and undergo a physical examination before deciding to sign.
I just am not going to get the story.
What do you mean?
Am I taking crazy pills? Like, why have the Seahawks not just locked this deal up?
Well, it does sound like they're offering more money than any other team right now. So I don't know if they want to bid against themselves.
So that's the deal, is the Seahawks have the best offer on the table.
That seems to be the current consensus of the reporting.
Okay. We don't know what that money looks like necessarily, what that number is, but
the indication was more in the 15 to 16 million range than the 13 to 15 million that had been speculated previously.
And he's just waiting just in case there's a 20 million out there or something.
Or an 18 or whatever it might be, yeah. It's not as much as he was hoping to get, and it appears that there could be more once teams can get a better, you know, understanding of his health.
Okay. Well, actually, I don't blame the Seahawks for that.
I mean, you could maybe offer a little bit more to take away that risk. Like, look, if they don't sign Clowney, they're going to be substantially worse. This offseason is going to be a tremendous step backwards for them if they don't re-sign
it. It Clowney. Really is like the difference between being – if they sign Clowney, I feel like the Seahawks are a Super Bowl contender. And if they don't, I don't think they are. Right?
Yeah. I still think they're a pretty fringe Super Bowl contender even with him, but yeah.
I mean, when you think of the individual teams, are there any that you can look at and be like, wow, they've really taken a step forward this offseason? And granted, the field is always stronger than any individual team.
I can think of a team that has taken a pretty big step forward this offseason.
Who's that?
I mean, I guess, you know, the quarterback upgrade is probably a little overrated, but Tampa Bay?
No. Get out of here. Get out of my face with that one. That's a no. That's a no, boss. No. You're talking about the team with a sorry 43-year-old quarterback who downgraded at quarterback?
I'm not willing to go that far.
I would take Jameis next year. If you give me apples to apples, Jameis versus Tom Brady's next year, I'm taking Jameis.
Is Jameis making $1.1 million in this scenario?
It doesn't matter.
Did you see the Brock Heward's poll of, like, hey, would you sign Cam Newton to the same deal that the Saints gave Jameis, and that 32% of people as of earlier this afternoon were voting no to that scenario?
Okay, so I don't mean to defend – all these people are really mad at Brock. I think Brock and Saul were down on the Seahawks draft.
I mean, my issue there, he just posed the question.
Is it unheard of that – Cam Newton signs a deal like that? Like, I think that's Jameis was way underpaid for the deal that he signed. So, like, is it absurd to think that Cam would sign a deal for that much money?
I'm sorry, I underestimated it. It was 38% said no.
But if I can defend the 38% of no's, I don't know if I just don't really under, like, personally, I would say yes. I don't think you threaten Russell Wilson's job for no reason.
you're not threatening the job by signing someone who is unsigned in April, released by his team, and is making the league minimum. That is in no sense a threat to his job.
Most of the country, I've seen polls on this, most of the country is dumb people. And the second that Russell Wilson, like if the Seahawks start out 2-2, those fuckers are going to be demanding for Cam Newton to start. And by, like, Anthony Gordon can be there. I honestly, in fact, in this moment, like, look, would I Russell rather Wilson is, Cam Newton as the backup quarterback? But also,
I don't know Russell if he's still the highest paid quarterback in the NFL. There is no scenario where, I mean, yeah, there's going to be some morons who say that. There also were people who thought Coach Pete should couldn't people be in this week's poll were unhappy with Coach Pete last year. But like people were saying that Coach Pete should get fired last year. Like there's going to be a lunatic fringe in any scenario.
Those people are reasonable individuals. I would be just as happy with them going into this next season, not off season, of course, this next season, which won't happen, with Anthony Gordon as I would be with them with Cam Newton.
That's a preposterous take.
Why? Why are you planning for Russell Wilson to get injured? Like,
He might get injured. Hey, why are you planning for a pandemic when there's not currently a pandemic? Oh, good call. Let's not plan for that. That's the logic losing here.
As a player, I would rather have Kaepernick than I'd rather have Cam Newton.
I would rather have Cam Newton, who last played in the NFL in September, than Colin Kaepernick, who last played in the NFL in 2015.
I'm just saying.
We're going to get to let's remember some years when Colin Kaepernick was last in the NFL not that long ago.
Anything to threaten Russell Wilson.
Nothing is going to threaten. You made him the fucking highest paid quarterback in the NFL. The guy making the minimum is in no sense going to threaten him.
It's a stature issue. If Cam Newton is in the locker room,
this is a ridiculous position.
If Cam Newton is in the locker room, undermining.
Why are you assuming that he's going to be undermining? And first off, if he is doing that, then you just fucking waive him.
Why do you take the risk?
Because it's not that big of a risk. This is a distraction issue. You're basically making the same argument that has kept Colin Kaepernick out of the NFL. So enjoy that, friend.
You're just wrong here.
I agree with Colin Kaepernick critics.
Well, I mean, like, there would be a tension, but it's not distraction. Like, with Colin Kaepernick and Cam Newton are different beasts. Like, the amount of people who would be calling for...
No one is going to be calling to bench Russell Wilson! Why are you operating out of the fear of this improbable scenario? Whereas the scenario that Russell Wilson, for some reason, is unable to play a football game, if any of us can play football games, is a much more likely scenario!
Cam Newton has won the fucking MVP. Like... You could divide the locker room with somebody who's won the MVP and is one of the most respected players. This is not an anti-Cam Newton take. This is a pro-Cam Newton take. I'm saying Cam Newton is a starting caliber NFL quarterback, and if you make him be a backup, it's a problem.
But you're not making him be a backup. The market is making him being a backup. He is choosing to be a backup. He's not – no one is – trading him here, he is signing here of his own free will and volition in this hypothetical scenario.
This is not an option that's on
the table. Why would you be against it not happening? This is your worst take in a long time.
You're just so wrong here. I voted yes.
Some guy with like eight numbers, some bot with like eight numbers in his username on Twitter is going to tweet about Cam Newton should start and that's why they shouldn't sign him.
Wrong.
You know Richard Sherman doesn't play for the Seahawks anymore, right? You know that he plays for the 49ers.
There's other players than Richard Sherman. Like,
yeah, they're all gone too. All of them are fucking gone.
You're not getting it. You're not getting it on it.
You're not getting it.
You're making this is like
Russell Wilson is unimpeachable.
Fucking tape grinder person.
Russell Wilson won the Super Bowl for the Seahawks. Cam Newton didn't win a Super Bowl for the Seahawks. He didn't win any Super Bowls at all.
He's won an MVP.
But certainly not for the Seahawks. Well, congrats. Sean Alexander won a fucking MVP, so enjoy that award.
I'm not saying you're not understanding what I'm saying. I'm saying there's a possibility of dividing.
There's a much more likely possibility of Anthony Gordon throwing 7 interceptions a game if Russell Wilson is unable to play.
If Russell Wilson is unable
to play, that's a more realistic possibility.
Over whether Cam Newton is there or not.
You try to put together the best team you have. Also, it's Pete Carroll. It's not like you're bringing him in to play for Jim Elmora, who's going to have to manage the locker room.
And you're so confident in Pete's ability to manage the locker room? Fuck that.
I'm confident in his ability to show trust and faith in Russell Wilson, who they made the highest paid quarterback in NFL history when he signed his contract last year. Yeah, I'm confident in that.
It's not worth the
also,
risk.
Also, they're going to run either way, so it doesn't matter.
Like, what? I don't think it's worth the risk. You've made me dig in on this point now. I was neutral, and you made me dig in on this point. Like, what is really? What do you gain by having a really good backup quarterback?
You gain security in case your starting quarterback is unable to play.
Also,
like, why do you have? Also, you. I mean, what do you gain by having good players? You should just have all bad players. That way no one can be concerned.
When was the last
Let's
time
have Cam bad backups at every position. QBR? When was the last time Anthony Gordon was good by QBR?
Cam Newton is not even that good of a quarterback.
Also, Cam Newton was pretty good at the start of the 2018 season. Like, their offense was playing quite well. When I watched that All or Nothing, like, I was very into the Panthers' offense.
Okay, that's nice. Tell me statistically, tell me quantitatively how he was by QBR, not by your fucking watching All or Nothing.
He was a 55, but again, he was playing through injury at that point.
Mm-hmm. Seems to always be.
Well, when was the last time? You know what's one way for him to not be injured? If he's a backup.
This is not where I expected this conversation to go.
I mean, his 55 QBR in 2018 is better than Geno Smith posted any season of his career, remember?
That's not the issue. No one thinks that Geno Smith should be starting.
No one thinks that Cam Newton should be starting.
Maybe you want
to start Russell in Cam Newton in a dual QB backfield, because that would actually be kind of amazing.
I'm giving a look right now. It's just like, I don't think you understand how big of an issue this would be. And the most sacred
I don't think you understand that Russell Wilson is the single most popular athlete in the history of Seattle sports.
He is not the single most popular athlete in the history of the Seahawks locker room. And never has been, never will be.
That was a different Seahawks locker room. You can't wrap your mind around the fact that that team is gone. These are a bunch of young players who their only memory and understanding of the Seahawks is Russell Wilson leading them to Super Bowls.
Cam Newton is a more relevant football player to young players than Russell Wilson is. People care more about
Poppycock.
Cam Newton as an athlete.
That is a preposterous take.
You don't
they may,
think so?
Maybe care about him more as a fashion icon. You don't think that Russell Wilson is, quote, in the zeitgeist?
He gets treated like a joke, though.
I don't think you're under... Do you know who Russell Wilson is? Are we talking about different people?
Do you know who Russell Wilson is?
This is the single worst take you have ever had in the history of the Pelton cast.
I'm just trying to protect Russell Wilson. That's all I care about. That's
protect
it.
Russell Wilson by giving him a fucking good backup.
How does that protect him? Maybe you should protect Russell Wilson by drafting him a goddamn wide receiver. Like, instead of being worried about who they fucking sign as his backup, maybe you should have given him some help in this draft. And
okay, but that's not the question we're discussing. None of this is within our control, by the way.
What?
But I wanted them to do that. I wanted them to make the right decision. They just didn't do it. I also would want them to make the right decision if hypothetically Cam Newton were available as a backup.
Great.
You would want them to make the wrong decision.
This is fucking clown business. Who cares? Cam Newton is not necessarily available for the same number that Jameis is.
He's probably not. But if he is, obviously is, you should sign him.
Okay, great. Sure. Sign Cam Newton. In this absurd hypothetical scenario, yes, sign Cam Newton. Most importantly, is we went through a draft and we shit on Russell Wilson by not drafting basically any offensive players who matter to him. There's one in Damian Lewis, and aside from that, there's basically nobody else who makes his life even remotely easier. And I mean,
I can think of scenarios where a 6'7" tight end might make his life easier. Like, I'm not counting on it, but to say that there's no chance of it, again, is preposterous.
We went into the most deep wide receiver draft of our lifetimes and didn't draft a wide receiver.
Look, you knew that was going to happen. The Seahawks don't...
I didn't know that was going to happen. I thought they would draft a fucking wide receiver. I had too much faith in this dumbass organization that has not drafted good for years.
Yeah.
And, I don't care about this hypothetical scenario that is about Cam Newton, because it doesn't fucking matter.
Well, you care about this hypothetical scenario where the Seahawks front office values receivers in the draft.
They have. They drafted DK Metcalf. They drafted Tyler Lockett. Like, they have in the past drafted wide receivers. But this year they decided to sit it out because they're dumb. They didn't draft the best player. They didn't draft for value. They didn't draft the best player available. They did nothing. They drafted the same fucking bullshit that they've drafted for the last 6 years.
Who are you arguing against here? Everyone on this podcast, including Zach, is third blood brother, permanent third blood brother, agrees with this take.
He seemed a little bit too positive to me, I have to be honest. I think Seahawks draft takes are a little bit too positive. There's no logic to be applied to it aside from the Seahawks think that they know better than every other team. That's it.
The Seahawks have always thought that, and sometimes they did.
When?
When they drafted Russell Wilson in the third round.
They were right about it, and not one time. I mean, there are obviously other times, but like really the amount that matters to us now is one time ever. And maybe they were a little bit ahead of the curve with regards to the draft 7 or 8 years ago. That's cool. We'll be remembering those years soon.
We sure will.
They completely fucked up this draft. And I don't know why we're even bothering.
I don't know why many times you need to say it. What we weren't planning to talk about that long.
A hypothetical scenario that revolves around a quarterback who could sign with any of the other 31 teams in the league and could do so. It's like, great. Have fun with that. But like,
the point is about the quality of the logic. It's about the process here, not whether this is actually reality. Like, hey, you know what else? You don't actually have $15 to spend to pick five players at these five positions. Oh, but people do it because of the fact that we need something to occupy our time during this quarantine, okay?
This, I'm saying that there is a certain element.
You don't actually have to just pick one. The other ones don't actually gotta go.
I don't think it's absurd, the 38% of people who are saying that they wouldn't sign Cam Newton.
Well, we'll see what the internet has to say.
But what? Because of what? Like, how are you going to see if there? Wherever? Like, how are you going to come back to this? If Cam Newton goes somewhere and there ends up being a quarterback controversy where he's at in week 4, then are you going to revisit this and be like, "Wow, I sure had the wrong opinion about that tweet there, that poll that Brock Heward had in April"? No.
There's probably going to be a controversy there because he's probably going to sign with a team that doesn't have Russell Wilson as a quarterback.
How many teams do you think have starting quarterbacks that are worse than Cam Newton right now? Or that you would rather start Cam Newton than? I think you're overvaluing Cam Newton.
I mean, how many teams have backups that you would rather have than Cam Newton? The answer is the Saints, and that's it. I don't
think you can look at it like that. Because
of course you can look at it. We're talking about him in a backup role.
We watched this fucking Bulls documentary this weekend, and they were talking about how important it is to have players who understand what their role is. Do you think Cam Newton
is signing here?
Do you think Cam Newton thinks he's a backup quarterback?
Do you think that Jameis Winston thinks that he's not one of the 32 best quarterbacks in the league?
Two best quarterbacks in the league?
Do you think that Jameis Winston thinks he's one of the 32 best quarterbacks?
Signing with a team who has a quarterback who's over 40 who missed six games this year.
Sure.
Jameis Winston didn't sign New Orleans to not play.
I think he had to go in there with the reality, with his eyes wide open, that he's not going to win the starting job if Drew Brees is healthy, and there's a chance that he plays zero games in 2020.
Russell Wilson and Drew Brees are a decade apart in age.
Sure. Again, I doubt that Cam Newton is interested in signing with the Seahawks. I'm just saying, if a good player is willing to play for you for the minimum, you sign that player. You don't come up with these ridiculous, but what about the locker room distraction? Because of the fact that Russell Wilson is, again, signed the most expensive quarterback contract for any player in the history of the National Football League last year, which is a pretty good indication that he is going to continue to start at quarterback for the Seattle Seahawks so long as he is healthy.
It is important to have players who know what their role is.
In this hypothetical, where Cam Newton is deciding to sign with the Seahawks as a free agent, where no one is forcing him to do it, no one is saying to him, other 31 teams gotta go, then he probably does that in the understanding that he's going to spend one season as a backup before going on a market that might be more favorable to him next offseason.
Okay, 2018 regular season, Cam Newton ranked 19th in QBR in the, I guess not quite the bottom third. 2017.
Basically average.
Below
I
average.
Mean, if he's...
2017 regular season, he ranked 19th in QBR. 2016 regular season, Cam Newton ranked 25th in QBR.
Remind me, which of these seasons did the Seahawks backup rank better than 25th in QBR?
11.
Remind me when you get to that season.
Was it 2015 that Cam Newton won the MVP?
Yeah, it was a preposterous decision.
Where he finished 11th in QBR.
We stipulate that.
I'm not saying
the point is not. The point is not that Cam Newton is a superstar.
Cam Newton finished 17th in QBR. Cam Newton is not a good enough player to be worth the fucking hassle of having Cam Newton.
It's not a hassle!
How do you not understand this on a basic
level? I'm sorry, one of us has been in a fucking locker room ever before in our life, but you continue to lecture me on what it's like in there, apparently.
You've been in a basketball locker room. Who's the NBA equivalent of Cam Newton? Carmelo? Would you sign Carmelo Anthony?
I mean, there is no equivalent in the NBA because there's not a position where you just play one player all the time.
Is it a coincidence that a team like the Lakers don't want to bring in a player like Carmelo Anthony, though?
I mean, Carmelo doesn't do any of the things they need or fit any need for them.
Well, neither does Cam Newton. What is the need for the Seahawks that Cam Newton fills?
And Carmelo Anthony is a sub-replacement player at this stage of his career, whereas Cam Newton, by the numbers you were pointing out, is solidly better than replacement.
I mean, I suppose so. We're still talking about... I'm not looking at the 2019 regular season. He was injured for most of the year.
Look, you're either competing or you're not. You're either competing to put together the best roster that you can.
You're competing. Yeah, no, there's a different level of competing. Competing is... You're just so off base on this. God, it drives me crazy. Competing is about putting together the best roster that you possibly can and minimizing Russell Wilson's impact and hurting his voice in the locker room or whatever. Even risking that is not competing.
Sometimes it's not a risk.
Absolute best players at every position isn't always the right way to approach things.
It's not a risk. Russell Wilson, again, the highest, signed the largest contract in the history of the NFL. If that's not a commitment to a player, I don't know what possibly is, other than, like, naming the franchise after him. Is that what you want to understand, that he's the certain starter?
I still sort of agree with you, but you're acting like it's a black and white decision, and it's not.
Of course it's a black and white decision.
It isn't! There are some things
to consider
about this.
Russell Wilson is so established as a quarterback. You don't seem to get this. This is not Russell Wilson versus Matt Flynn in 2012. This is Russell Wilson as, again, the largest contract in NFL history. Super Bowl champion. X-time Pro Bowler. He is the starting quarterback. It doesn't matter who they fucking sign. They could sign Tom Brady, and Russell Wilson is still going to be the unquestioned starting quarterback.
Do you think that Cam Newton ranks notably higher,
it doesn't matter
in the NFL rank than he does in QBR?
It doesn't matter where Cam Newton ranks among all quarterbacks. What matters is where he ranks among backup quarterbacks, because we're not talking about the Seahawks signing him as a starter.
I'm talking about NFL rank as defined by the players voting on things.
I mean, I don't know where he
ranks
in the NFL.
Disproportionately high in that than he should be versus statistically, right? This is not, it's just about Cam Newton as a player. Honestly,
ranked,
if we're talking Jameis
Winston, he ranked 87th last season.
I mean, he's, by statistically, he's not a top 100 player.
Russell
this
Wilson
was
ranked,
in 2020?
This is in 2019, which is the year that recently passed.
Yeah.
Russell Wilson somehow inexplicably came in 25th. But you're also talking about all NFL players. You're not talking about the players who watched Russell Wilson bail their asses out every single week last season. And, of course, that difference would be greater this year than it would be in 2019.
Where did you find the NFL rank?
What?
Where did you find that?
I found it on Google. I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
I typed in NFL rank 2018. It came up with the NFL standings. 87th
in
2019.
It was 2019. I know you haven't. He was number 11 in 2018.
Oh, number 11 in 2018. Where did Russell Wilson?
That's Russell rank? Wilson was number 11, not Cam Newton.
Oh, okay. Okay, thank God. I'm just saying, Cam Newton is a singularly difficult NFL player in as much as he is respected more by NFL players than his ability. That's it. You don't agree with that?
To some extent.
There are certain players, and it's the same thing that we talked about with Carmelo. Like, you don't think that's a fair comparison? Like, NBA players overvalue Carmelo Anthony's ability as an NBA player because he was good in the early 2000s or whatever. And because he's highly respected among players. And it means that he is a more difficult player to integrate into a team than an average role player would be.
I don't think that you're understanding how many players on the NFL 100 are quarterbacks.
Are there that many who are quarterbacks?
Placing 87th last year ranked him 14th among quarterbacks. So he was 5 spots higher than he finished in QBR the previous season. I mean, sure, yeah, there's a little bit of a perception gap.
He was,
but there's not the same as Carmelo Anthony.
In 2018, he was 25th. You're just using 2019 as if it's like a
factor. Because that's what year is most recent! It doesn't matter what people thought about him 2 years ago. People have updated their perceptions!
They don't. Cam Newton is one of the most respected players in the NFL.
He is! Like, I don't dispute that. You know who's more respected than him? Russell Wilson, the guy who's consistently been ranking higher than him every year. In place for the Seahawks, currently, is not a stranger to these people. It is not coming in there, you know, having been humbled by having to take a minimum salary as a backup after he was released by the only team that he ever played for. But none of that is apparently relevant in your mind.
You're acting like there's not a risk at all, and I think you're wrong about that. That's it.
The risk is gone as soon as you make someone the highest paid player in the NFL.
I think that Russell Wilson has always been the least respected quarterback in the NFL. And you think that I'm totally wrong about that? I think Russell Wilson is maybe the best quarterback. Respected.
I mean,
the second best quarterback in the NFL for most of his career,
like,
and has never been perceived as that.
Who is the guy for the Bills who replaced Tyrod Taylor? No, the Peterman. I think the Peterman is probably less respected than Russell Wilson. I don't know, just the take I have.
I'm saying vis-a-vis their ability. Russell Wilson has never been perceived as good. Like, he's never won a fucking
Again,
MVP.
Again, he was number 11.
He's better than Cam Newton every single year of his career.
Cam Newton won the MVP because they had a 15-1 record, not because people actually thought he was the best quarterback
Russell
in the league.
Russell Wilson won the fucking won the Super Bowl, was the number one seed 2 years in a row, and he didn't win any fucking MVP then. Where does respect go?
I mean, number one, those teams were not as dominant record-wise in the regular season as those Panthers were. He lost the MVP to players who, you know, I think probably had better records. Like Peyton Manning in 2013, that Denver had a better record, didn't they? But also, I'm aware of what happened in the Super Bowl. We'll remember it at some point. But also, the perception at that period of time was that Russell Wilson was carried by his run game and the defense. That perception is no longer the case. They actually had identical records in 2013, but it's not like, again, the Seahawks have never gone 15-1 in a season like the Panthers did in 2015.
They really went 15-1.
They sure did, bud.
What was their schedule? God.
Well, did they beat the Seahawks that year?
Well, in the playoffs, sure, if that game goes five quarters, the Seahawks win. They lost
no,
the schedule.
They don't.
It was dewy that morning.
But also the beat the Seahawks in the regular season in Seattle, 27-23.
I think it was rainy that day. No, I don't remember that win. That loss.
And it's because of that game that many Seahawks players that are still on the roster from 2015 will all believe that Cam Newton is a better quarterback than Russell Wilson and should start over him.
I would rather have Anthony Gordon. If Russell Wilson gets hurt, we know that Colin Kaepernick is out there. That's the thing. It's like, we know that their quarterback's
Colin Kaepernick hasn't played in the NFL in 4 years. I don't think you can expect him to just come in with never having run their system before, and all of a sudden, like, he's going to start the next game and it'll be fine. Like, that is not a realistic proposition. First off, they wouldn't sign Colin Kaepernick. Like, that's over. Colin Kaepernick is not playing in the NFL again. Like, you got to give up that hope. But second off, it's really unfair to say, all right, we're just going to sign you in the middle of on a Tuesday, and like you got to start on Sunday. Like, that is not a fair 4 years after you last played in the game. That is a very different proposition than the idea of having a quality backup in camp all year, working with the team, playing preseason, and then not actually playing games because we're not going to have any games in 2020. But hypothetically, again, this is strictly all hypothetical. That's not the same thing.
What do you make of this Oxford study? Feels pretty promising, right?
We'll see.
You don't even see my perspective about Cam Newton.
Not in this scenario, no.
I think you're not understanding the types of personalities that NFL players have.
When you give somebody the most money in franchise in league history, then the worry about, I don't know, have we shown enough commitment to him? Is he our guy? That goes out the window.
It's not about that. It's about your fucking, like, your starting defensive end. Are they like, well, fuck, we just lost this game. I'm blaming that guy. The quarterback always gets the blame. And if you have a shiny new quarterback like Cam Newton sitting back there, it is a threat.
That's insane. No.
The Seahawks are not signing Cam Newton, so it doesn't matter because they see it more like I do than you do.
They do not see it like you do. Do you ever listen to literally anything Pete Carroll has ever said in his entire life? The man's entire ethos is about competition.
But why did he never sign Kaepernick?
Because of the fact that they don't want a, like, political figure in their locker room. You know that. You know that's why it is. Like, why are you beating around the bush about it? Either that or they just don't think he's any good. I mean, I guess that's possible.
I mean, I think Cam Newton's better than Kaepernick is, but I guess I agree that they don't want a political figure in their locker room, but the reason they don't is because they don't want the circus. And Cam Newton brings, like, 65% of the circus.
Cam Newton, if you're coming in as a backup to Russell Wilson,
yeah, it's the reason he's humbling this fucking experience. Cam Newton fucking sucks.
I think Cam Newton's actually okay. I think he was hurt last year and people overjudged it.
He's at best at an average quarterback.
The Panthers offense was legitimately awesome the first few weeks of 2018 before he like couldn't throw the ball more than 10 yards because his shoulder was bad.
Well, it's funny that Brock really got people this riled up about it.
I mean, basically, what it is, it's revealing to people that not everyone understands things.
What things?
The value of having a quality backup quarterback.
Well, I like that we got to get our first take on, or whatever. We get to have two different sides of this opinion that maybe we don't necessarily disagree on, because I definitely voted on the poll.
No, we disagree.
I voted.
Oh, you voted yes?
Yeah, of course.
Well, what the fuck then?
But at the same time, you're acting like it's such a black and white issue. I'm saying there, and also I voted yes from this scenario of like, this is never going to happen, so who cares? If it came down to it in reality, I would be like, excited about Cam Newton, but also I'd be like, I don't know, this makes me a little bit nervous.
Like, Russell Wilson is the fucking president.
He has never been that here, though.
Maybe he has. I don't know how you're not seeing this.
Maybe
because you're too online, first off.
How am I too online, but you're not?
Because I have more perspective on things, apparently.
Oh, God. I'm just... I feel like Russ has never gotten the respect that he deserves.
But, sure, does Russell Wilson deserve more credit for his play? Of course he does. But Russell Wilson gets a lot of fucking credit.
Could and should be more.
He gets more credit for his play than Cam Newton, aside from this MVP that was bullshit.
I don't think that's true. But proportionate to their ability? That's not true.
But that's not the scale. I'm not saying proportionate to their ability. I'm saying who gets more respect, Cam Newton or Russell Wilson? The answer is Russell Wilson.
Among NFL players or among press?
I
think Cam Newton is a really respected NFL player.
Then why is he so low in the fucking poll?
But
your own evidence argues against you.
He's not that low. You went to one poll. Did you look at the previous year? He was number 25 when he was like...
Okay, and Russell Wilson was 11. The year before that, he was 44. Russell Wilson was 24. He was only, after he won the MVP, was literally the only time in his entire career since Russ's like second season that he is rated higher than Russell Wilson.
He's always been like...
It doesn't matter the relative shit! It only matters the absolute shit!
If you are a bad quarterback, but you get perceived as a good quarterback...
He's not a bad quarterback! He's an average quarterback who was briefly for a shot of... Like... A moment in the sun, considered the best quarterback in the NFL. And then, all information came in, and people quickly updated perceptions, and he went from number one in 2016 to number 44 in 2017.
Number one ever. Russell Wilson has never sniffed number one.
I can't. Oh. This podcast is over.